Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We're going to take a detour today to the economic land of what would happen if the housing market were normal. Not booming, mind you, just normal. Also, how a slice of the bond market might be the next sign of trouble. And really, it pays to say thank you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. Coverage of the economy is supported in part by the Schuman Center for Media and Democracy.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you with us on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 22nd of December today. And we got some okay economic numbers this morning. Existing home sales were up, the third bump in the past 4 months. Third quarter gross domestic product grew at a clip of 2.6%. That's an upward revision from earlier reports. But here's the thing. Both of those numbers were below expectations, below what economists would like to see in what is, it has to be said, month 18 of the official economic recovery. So we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to adjust those expectations, to look at the housing market, often an indicator of how the economy as a whole is going to perform, just to see how different things might be if housing were normal right now.
2002 was considered a normal year for housing, not too hot, not too cold. That year, home builders put up about 1.7 million homes.
Right now, we're way below.
Bernie Markstein is chief economist at the National Association of Home Builders, and he says we'll be lucky to break ground on 600,000 new homes this year. That's just a third the level Markstein would consider healthy, enough new homes to keep up with normal population growth, not to mention meet all the pent-up demand from the recession.
In past recoveries, it's been housing that's helped pull the economy out of recession. This time, it's the economy that has to help pull housing out of recession.
But that's not too likely. Unemployment's expected to remain high, and that's partly because we've lost 1.5 million construction jobs. Those won't come back anytime soon because we built way too many homes during the boom years, and they still need to be sold off, says Anika Khan at Wells Fargo Securities.
As the housing market corrects, it's going to be an agonizingly slow recovery well into 2014, 2015.
And what might that look like to people in the housing market?
I'm looking forward to a new normal.
Carmen Ryan is a broker in Portland, Oregon.
Housing prices keep track with the income level because I think we got out of whack.
Ryan says no more double-digit price rises year over year, no more taking equity out of your home and living on debt. That's what a healthy housing market will look like in years to come. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We're going to take a minute here and tap into the economic zeitgeist, not the holiday retail sales thing that everybody else is doing or the tax deal thing in Washington that's done already or even worries about the deficit. There has been some buzz the past couple of days about a corner of the bond market that might be bringing trouble. Munis, municipal bonds that local governments use to get their working capital. From New York, Marketplace's Janet Babin has more.
Star analyst Meredith Whitney made her latest prediction on CBS's 60 Minutes. She expects hundreds of billions of dollars of municipal bond defaults next year.
Next to housing, this is the single most important issue in the United States and certainly the largest threat to the U.S. economy.
To put Whitney's prediction into perspective, the one-year record for municipal bond defaults was just over $8 billion set in the tumult that was 2008. Bloomberg columnist Joe Misak calls Whitney's comments reckless.
To say all of a sudden that hundreds of billions of dollars of municipal bonds will default, the number is in the realm of the fabulous.
Not that Misak is Mr. Brightside. He says there very well may be municipal defaults totaling $5 to $10 billion next year. But he expects the trouble to surface in bonds that fund nursing homes or nonprofits. Those organizations often partner with local governments on bonds, so they qualify for tax-free financing. Really, the last thing cities and towns want to do is default. It makes it even harder to borrow money and get out of financial trouble. Plus, Richard Cicerone at McDonnell Investment Management says there's evidence that some economies are stabilizing.
One economic source that we rely on looks for a 4% GDP growth rate next year.
The more growth, the higher the potential tax rolls, the more remote the chance of default. Still, parts of New Jersey, California, Arizona, and elsewhere have more bills outstanding than cash in hand. Analyst Steve Murphy at Standard & Poor's lays out the options: raise taxes and cut services.
There are very difficult decisions that have to be made, so they will wait until the last minute, but history has shown us that they will make the choices they have to.
That might not sit well, though, with the residents of these broke cities and towns who have to live with the choices. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
For those who have yet to buy their get-out-of-town-for-the-holidays plane tickets, this story. If you want to fly American Airlines, you're not going to find their fares on the website Orbitz today. American has pulled its tickets from the online travel site. Delta is taking its fares off some smaller travel sites as well. Moving away from easy online sales might seem risky, but Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports the big carriers are in a position to gamble.
The major airlines are flying high. They've got $23 billion stored away for a rainy day. This year, the industry has collected $4 billion in fees, for example, to passengers who check in bags or change flights. Douglas Quimby is a travel analyst with Focusrite.
For the first time in a long time, the airlines have really navigated through the recession very smartly.
Some of the airlines have merged and cut back on flights that weren't in demand.
But as travelers have started to come back, airlines have not been so quick to bring those seats back into the marketplace. So they have less need for third parties.
Middlemen who sell the excess seats but take a cut. Direct sales give the airlines more power to determine what they charge for fares. Travel marketing expert Peter Yesowicz says the other big carriers will be watching Delta and American.
If they are able to come through this period in a healthier and a more competitive position, I think you can pretty much expect you'll see some other airlines that will follow suit.
So what does this mean for you?
Well, there's the bad news. And that is, as they recapture this pricing power, the inevitable outcome of that is you're going to see an increase in fares and an increase in rates.
Merry Christmas. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
President Obama held his end-of-the-year press conference today before taking a week or so with the family out in Hawaii. Of interest to us was this line. The president said the economy will be his, quote, singular focus the next 2 years. And then he said voters are going to hold both parties responsible if things don't get better. All right, so unless tomorrow knocks it out of the park, there is not going to be a 2010 Santa Claus rally. But the major indices did end higher today. Details, numbers, when we get there. This may not be the perfect moment to mention this. What with all the holiday spending that's going on out there and the fact that the economy needs that spending. But we are actually saving more now than we used to. And commentator David Frum says that's a good thing.
Americans are saving again. More than 6 cents out of every paycheck goes unspent. A big change from the past decade when the saving rate dropped to nearly nothing. Is the change permanent? Or will all our good resolutions dissipate with a reviving economy? We all could use a new pair of shoes. I'll go out on a limb here and propose, yes, I think the change will endure. Americans have passed through a searing generational experience. Nobody who lived through the crash of 2008 will ever again believe that a rising home price or stock portfolio can substitute for money in the bank. More than 14 million Americans still owe more on their homes than their homes are worth. They have to save if they ever wish to move without defaulting on their loan. The biggest bulge of the baby boom, Americans born after 1958, are moving into their 50s. For most of us, the last clear chance to accumulate financial assets before retirement. This president's deficit commission may go nowhere. But I think we all sense that people who retire in, say, the 2020s will be receiving a less generous deal from the government than people who retired in the 1990s. So we'd better prepare accordingly. international comparisons of savings rates are shaky. Countries calculate these statistics in different ways. But our future may look more like the double-digit savings rates of Japan and Germany than like the profligate past, where we thought our houses would do our saving for us.
David Frum is the founder of Frum Forum, and in a past life, he was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Next Wednesday, Robert Reich. Your thoughts anytime. Just stop by our website, marketplace.org. This has been a big year for the Chinese economy, having escaped the global recession mostly intact. It passed Japan to become the second largest economy in the world behind the United States. It's had double-digit growth for most of the past 10 years, and yet not all is entirely well. Our Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz is on the line to talk all things China as 2010 comes to a close. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
So listen, before we get started, do a little compare and contrast for me. You lived in China 15 years ago. You got back 6 months ago for us. Talk to me about the big changes you've seen this year.
Well, you know, I've seen changes since I've been here. I mean, for the past 10 years, in addition to growing its economy exponentially, I feel like China's been in a campaign mode. First, it was the Beijing Olympics in 2008, and then Shanghai's World's Fair this year. You know, all of that's over now. And those countdown clocks that you'd see all over the place, letting you know how many days before the next event, you know, those are all in storage. There's not another big event to look forward to. There's this big vacuum that hasn't been filled. I sort of feel like China's in a transition period right now. The economy's still going strong, but this lack of a big national event to prepare for has, in some ways, given people a chance to take a look around and see how they're doing individually as opposed to how the country's doing.
And what do you think people are saying?
Well, I was in the cab the other day, and the driver was excited that I spoke Chinese, which happens a lot. And he was,
which is great, yeah.
And he was curious about what I thought of Shanghai. Now, if you ever want to know what the Chinese really think about China, all you have to do is tell them how great you think China is. And I said something painfully obvious, like, boy, the economy's developing really quickly here. And that started a tirade against China that lasted the rest of my cab trip. The cabbie complained about how Shanghai spent too much money on the World's Fair, how despite all these fancy new buildings you see all over the city, most people like him weren't seeing any of that new money. And there's something to this. When you break down how the economy has grown in China over the years, you'll see that while household income has risen, it hasn't risen as much as China's GDP has. So essentially, you've got all this extra money in China that isn't going to people like that taxi driver.
Right. So the economy's growing faster than everybody's income. So where's the money going then, all that extra money?
The bulk of China's economic growth goes into things like those new fancy buildings the cabbie was talking about. Investment-led growth plays a big part in China's economy, building things, a high-rise suburb or a bullet train line. The other big part of China's economic growth is something we can all see under the Christmas tree, exports. Growth from investment and exports make up around two-thirds of China's overall growth. Consumption, or people buying stuff, makes up only about a third. And for the first time this year, policymakers in Beijing are starting to publicly admit that this is a problem.
And that's because the Chinese government now thinks the economy is unbalanced, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the buzzword among China economists these days, an unbalanced economy. I mean, here's why they think it's a problem. If most of China's money is in the hands of those who invest and export, i.e. the government, developers, factory owners, that means less money is going to China's working class. I mentioned household income before. It wasn't rising as fast as GDP in China. Well, that's the reason why the Chinese are slow to consume. They can't afford to. In the meantime, more money is going to real estate development and state-owned enterprises, and that's being funded through loans, and we're talking a lot of lending. All this debt has come to equal a fifth of China's entire GDP. In order to sustain this kind of economic growth, China's in sort of a trap. It needs to keep investing. So here's the danger. The value of those investments won't always go up. If and when the value of those investments goes down, China's government banks will take a hit.
Well, let's take the phrase command economy literally here, even though we all know that China's not really a command economy. What's the government doing about it?
Well, I think most economists would say not enough. What they say China should be doing boils down to three things: raise interest rates, raise wages, and raise the currency. China's already starting to raise interest rates, and the reason that's important is that it slows down borrowing for these massive investment projects. Raising wages is going to hurt employers, but it'll give hundreds of millions of workers more money to buy stuff. And the big one is, of course, the currency. China's currency is undervalued, and that makes imports in China more expensive for the Chinese to buy. and a more valuable currency would increase the value of Chinese exports, and that would help draw down China's massive trade surplus with the U.S., something a lot of people think would be great.
Rob Schmitz, a look back and a little bit of a look forward from Shanghai. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Guy.
Coming up, how to keep your customers coming back.
I've written at least 2,000 thank yous in just in the last 12 months.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 26 points this Wednesday, 0.25%, finished at 11,559. The NASDAQ edged up 3 points, 0.1%, closed at 2671. That is, by the way, a three-year high for the NASDAQ. The S&P 500 rose 4 points, 0.33%. Finished at 1258. Bank of America increased 3% today. Morgan Stanley and JP Morgan Chase both climbed more than 2%. Wells Fargo up 1.5%. Orbitz slid 5.75% today. That is, as we told you, after American Airlines pulled its flight from the travel website. AMR, the parent company of American Airlines, also descended 1.25% today. Shoemaker Nike stumbled almost 6% today. That after a disappointing earnings report, the sports apparel store Finish Line flopped more than 7% on lower income expectations. The drugstore chain Walgreens concocted a 5.5% gain after reporting good quarterly profits. Bonds dipped down. The yield on the 10-year T-note bumped up to 3.34%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace datebook for events coming up tomorrow. The clock is ticking. Only a couple of more days to shop before Christmas. Speaking of shopping, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for November. And what about radishes? They're not just for salad. In Mexico, Oaxacans celebrate Noche de Rabanos, or Night of the Radishes. Imagine sculptures of animals and people set in nativity scenes made of radishes. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The White House is sticking up for American wind power. Today, the Obama administration made a formal complaint to the World Trade Organization. It says China is illegally subsidizing its wind companies. And that may or may not be true. There will be claims and counterclaims and an investigation. But either way, foreign competition is only one challenge that American wind power companies have to deal with. Last week, their unofficial spokesman, billionaire oilman T. Boone Pickett, stuck his finger up in the air and took wind power out of his plan for America. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
T. Boone Pickens once planned to build the largest wind farm on Earth. Here's a commercial from his website.
We have the best wind corridor in the world. We're going to revitalize rural America with this.
2 years ago, Pickens placed a $1.5 billion wind turbine order from GE. But the problem? Transporting the energy from West Texas to the rest of the state. Pickens planned to build his own transmission, but the approvals fell through, says economist Mike Guyberson at Texas Tech.
Well, that sort of torpedoed his transmission line project, which meant that he didn't have a good way to develop and sell that power.
Hello, GE. Cancel those turbines. And delete wind power from Pickens' public plan for America's future. Now, the other half of his plan, homegrown natural gas, is the only part. Here's the new commercial.
We're going to figure out how to use it. If we don't, I promise you, we will go down as the absolute dumbest crowd that ever came on the street.
Thanks to new drilling technology, natural gas is abundant and cheap, which makes things tough for everything else. Coal, solar, wind. Financial consultant Ray Perryman.
relative prices do matter, and there are times when things work in a market and times when they don't. Right now, natural gas prices are lower, and when you have to make it work for investors every quarter, that creates some issues.
But in the energy business, the issues, as in volatility, never go away. Perryman has seen oil at $8 and $108. With natural gas, there are no guarantees either. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
It's Wednesday. That means it's your turn.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Our story on the ever-shrinking office cubicle and the shift to more collaborative workspaces generated some comments from you. Seems a lot of people like being able to see and talk freely with their coworkers whenever they want. Cheryl Scott of Dallas, Texas, though, not a fan.
The lack of cubicles with the little bit of privacy they offer may be fine for younger workers that have very simple, uncomplicated lives. But as you gain spouses and children and aging parents and possibly medical conditions, that little bit of privacy offers you a little bit of dignity with your coworkers.
Christina West of Silverthorne, Colorado, wonders why most workers even need to go to an office. She thinks we ought to get to choose. I trust my employees, she writes, that they're working and we collaborate by Skype and we save the planet by not commuting. This being the season for the buying of presents, our Freakonomics Radio segment this past week was about deadweight loss. That's kind of a fancy way to say gifts you don't really want. Melanie Watkins of Oxford, Mississippi, says she's totally behind asking for what you want. She wrote, "Gifts I receive that I don't want or don't need go straight to charity. In fact, I often wish the giver had given straight to charity themselves. I've already got enough clutter in my life," she says. Joel Riddle of Richmond, Indiana, though, decided to do something else, hold an experiment with his office holiday gift exchange.
After our party, I sent an anonymous survey to the participants. 22 of the 27 responded and indicated that based solely on the gift's values, we lost nearly 15%. When the entertainment value was added, we gained 25%.
So there you have it. Even homemade fruitcake or tacky reindeer sweaters have value under the right conditions. We always value what you have to say, no matter the condition. Send us your comments, suggestions, worst office gift stories, whatever you like. We're online at marketplace.org. Just look for that link that says contact. We all know that expressing gratitude is important. The social virtues of a simple thank you were drummed into most of us at an early age. And once we caught on, we needed only occasional prompting from mom or dad to straighten up and fly right. Economically, the recession might have been just the reminder the retail industry needed about the importance of a well-placed thanks. Sally Herships has more.
Sarah Seward is 24. She lives in Chicago. A couple of months ago, she hit a department store with her mom and her sister. They were shopping for purses.
And as soon as we got there into the purse section, one of the saleswomen immediately approached us and was really attentive. She pulled purses from the back. She went through different options, different colors.
Typical shopping experience, right? As long as you get an attentive salesperson, like Sarah did. She and her mom ended up buying a purse apiece. Then, a couple weeks later, they both got letters in the mail from the saleswoman who'd helped them. They were thank you notes.
It was a fully handwritten note referencing the exact bag we purchased. And on my note, she even had a nice reference to our alma mater.
Turns out they'd gone to the same school. And I'll admit, the purse Sarah bought wasn't exactly cheap. It was Marc Jacobs, about $400. But it's not just pricey department stores that are beefing up their manners. When the recession hit, JCPenney started a customer service program called GREAT. It's an acronym for salespeople. Greet, respect, engage, assist, and thank. And other retailers are following suit.
I've written at least 2,000 thank yous in the last 12 months.
Brett Broll owns Scrubadoo.com. He sells medical scrubs. You know, those pastel-colored outfits doctors and nurses wear. Broll says he hand-writes a thank you note for every single customer. Scrubadoo is a new company, and Brohl says there are a lot of websites out there selling the exact same products he does.
If you Google the word scrubs, we're not on the front page, we're not on the second page. And just like every other industry, right now, I mean, competition's tough, and with less people buying, it's even tougher.
Brohl says a new company like his can't afford major marketing, like TV commercials. Instead, he says he's counting on thank you notes to help Scrubadoo stand out. So, is this the beginning of a new trend of exemplary customer service? Nancy Kane is a retail historian at Harvard. She says, for smart businesses, it is.
We're returning to civility, courtesy, and a way of, you know, actually honoring customers that has seemed far too absent, I think, for the last 20 years.
Kane says the role of the salesperson has changed a lot over the decades. Before the recession, a salesperson's job had morphed into managing transactions, bagging groceries, dispensing coffee, ringing up a sale. She says the more we've absorbed technology, like self-service checkout at the grocery store, the more retail businesses have reduced service. Now, the role of the salesperson is changing again. I'm at a perfume counter at Saks Fifth Avenue with James McLaughlin. He works for a fragrance company called Jo Malone. McLaughlin says its salespeople have been sending thank you notes for years. They're scented. But now, he says, the company spends 20% more time on expressing gratitude to customers, everything from hand and arm massages to wine tastings.
We oftentimes will liken this experience as like dating. You have a really great first date, and then the person calls you 3 months later when there's a sale going on and says, oh, how about a second date? And why would they bother? You didn't keep in touch.
But Chicago shopper Sarah Seward's salesperson did. Remember the one who sent her the thank you note after she and her mom bought purses? It worked. Seward says she just bought another bag. So, thank you for listening. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, which I do believe qualifies as this week's sign, the apocalypse is upon us. You know Snuggies, those somewhat ridiculous-looking blanket things with the sleeves? Well, from the pages of the New York Times comes this statistic. By the end of this holiday season, there will be 25 million Snuggies in circulation. That's enough for one out of every 12 Americans to get cozy in, which leaves me with this. If you're warm, who cares how you look, right? Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday. Today, the Dow climbed 26 points, 0.25%, finished at 11,559. The NASDAQ edged up 3 points, 0.1%, 2671 at the bell. The S&P 500 ticked up 4 points, 0.3%, finished at 1258. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back on The Big Show.
If your Santa Claus was an engineer, what would you like for your next Christmas?
I don't know. A special kind of Christmas wish list. Tomorrow, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.